Hello and welcome to the Lemon Tree Coaching Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Allison Succomelli. Each week, I'll be taking the science of positive psychology, adding a little humor, and through evidence-based research, provide you with tools and strategies to help you live a life of peace and purpose. In this episode, I will be talking about excuses versus explanations, love hormones, and why our first love has lifelong psychological effects. But first, if you're interested, social media links, my website, and other information can be found at thelemontreecoaching.com. You can also click the link in the podcast bio. And if you'd like some daily inspiration, you can follow me on Instagram at thelemontreecoaching. I post quotes and make book recommendations from time to time. Currently in my reading stack this week, only to name a couple, I have The Diary of Frida Kahlo, An Intimate Self-Portrait, with an introduction by Carlos Fuentes, an essay and commentaries by Sarah M. Lowe, and The Psychology of Money, Timeless Lessons on Wealth, Greed, and Happiness by Morgan Housel. And teachers, you may want to check out my TPT shop called The Lemon Tree by AKS. There are some free lessons you can download or explore the shop for more. So check it out. Again, my shop is The Lemon Tree by AKS on teacherspayteachers.com. You can find a direct link in the podcast bio or my podcast website, thelemontreecoaching.com. Okay, with that said, let's get into this week's episode. Welcome back to the Lemon Tree Coaching Podcast and happy Valentine's Day. It doesn't matter if you are single, in a relationship, or whatever the case may be, because to have true, authentic love, you first need to have self-love, and we are all a work in progress. So let's reframe what this day means and move beyond all the marketing and expectations and engage in some self-love, which is awesome whether you are attached or flying solo this time of year. This day should be first and foremost about self-love, which empowers you to love another in a much deeper way. Explore that a little bit today. And someone asked a great question this week in connection with episode number 52, Sincere and Insincere Apologies, Authenticity versus Strategic Nature, How to Make a Meaningful Apology, and Weaponized Remorse. The question was, what's the difference between an excuse and an explanation? So let me further explicate. Often, if someone is feeling attacked, they instantly become defensive and make excuses. They do not take responsibility for the wrongdoing and deflect that responsibility onto someone else. Defensiveness can be exhibited in several ways. For instance, if someone brings up how you hurt their feelings, a defensive response may be, you are blaming them for having hurt feelings, accusing them of being defensive, making justifications for your actions, saying things like you felt you were backed into a corner, you refusing to hear how you hurt the other person, or not validating the other person's feelings by telling them they should feel the way they do, that they shouldn't feel the way they do. People make excuses to distance themselves from being at fault or push away from fault as much as possible. It's not taking accountability for their actions. It may be accompanied by a sad puppy dog face or Eeyore-like demeanor that is meant to make the person they hurt feel bad for them and get them to make them feel better about hurting them in the first place. And that's a lot of thems. So to clarify, person A is hurt by person B. Person B does not want to take accountability for hurting person A. Person B then puts on this act or sad puppy dog face that is meant to make person A feel bad or sorry for person B. And person B wants person A to make person B feel better about hurting person A in the first place. And why, you might ask? Because as human beings, we want to lessen the potential burden of feeling shame or guilt. We want to shift the blame elsewhere to protect our self-esteem or find a less threatening justification for why we committed a perceived wrongdoing by another. It's easy to say, I'm so stupid, I didn't know, or I'm so forgetful, and dismiss or lessen the burden of actual accountability. Doing this also minimizes harm to another person and makes it easier to justify actions and dismiss behaviors. A true apology cannot be tainted with excuses. On the other hand, an explanation helps to clarify the circumstances of a specific event or wrongdoing. An explanation is intended to give someone all of the facts in connection with a specific event or given circumstances. This can be challenging and confusing because people often have trouble explaining what happened without turning it into an excuse. And Julie Corliss of Harvard Health Publishing says, "The challenge here is to explain how the offense occurred without excusing it. In fact, sometimes the best strategy is to say there is no excuse. The words you choose for your apology count. Here are some examples of good and bad apologies. Effective wording example. I'm sorry I lost my temper last night. I've been under a lot of pressure at work, but that's no excuse for my behavior. I love you and will try harder not to take my frustrations out on you." So why it works? It takes responsibility, explains but does not excuse why the mistake happened, expresses remorse and caring, and promises reparation. Another example of an apology with effective wording: I forgot. I apologize for this mistake. It shouldn't have happened. What can I do to avoid this problem in the future? So why this example works: it takes responsibility, describes the mistake, makes the person feel cared for, and begins a conversation about how to remedy the error. And how do you know if an apology is poorly worded? A poorly worded apology consists of vague language and the offense is not specified. For instance, a poorly worded apology will sound like this: I apologize for whatever happened. Or, I made a mistake. The wrongdoer uses a passive voice and avoids taking responsibility. Here is another example of a poorly worded apology. I said I was sorry. I didn't know you were so sensitive about it. This pushes the blame back onto the offended person. So the main difference between an excuse and an explanation is taking accountability and being proactive. Excuses push away responsibility, while explanations help clarify specific circumstances. Excuses have negative connotations associated with blame and fault. We also need to be careful when it comes to making an explanation, as an explanation can easily become an excuse if we shift blame to others, regardless of how accurate that shifting of blame may be. Simply put, an excuse is a defense, justification, and sometimes an alibi. An explanation is a clarification, an account, and if we're fortunate, enlightenment or some sort of personal growth. So hopefully that clears things up. All right, in the spirit of Valentine's Day, let's shift our attention to what we call the love hormones. First, let's define love itself. According to the APA Dictionary of Psychology, love is a complex emotion involving strong feelings of affection and tenderness for the love object, pleasurable sensations in their presence, devotion to their well-being, and sensitivity to their reactions to oneself. Although love takes many forms, including concern for one's fellow humans or brotherly love, parental love, erotic love, self-love, and identification with the totality of being or love of God, the triangular theory of love proposes three essential components: passion, intimacy, and commitment. Social psychological research in this area has focused largely on passionate love, in which sexual desire and excitement predominate, and companionate love in which passion is relatively weak and commitment is strong. Love is being sincerely invested in another person's well-being. So a lot to unpack here. And biological anthropologist Helen Fisher completed a study in 2005 that found that romantic love is primarily a motivation system rather than an emotion or set of emotions. With that in mind, let's get into the neuroscience of it all and what happens in your brain when you fall in love. The players in the case of love hormones include oxytocin, dopamine, norepinephrine, cortisol, and serotonin. Oxytocin is often referred to as the love hormone. It helps people to read social cues better as well as foster positivity resonance, which we'll talk about more in a minute, and promotes positive feelings. Oxytocin is responsible for our feelings of attachment and intimacy. This hormone is produced in the hypothalamus and released into the bloodstream by the pituitary gland. Oxytocin's main function is to facilitate childbirth, which is one of the reasons it is called the love hormone. After childbirth, oxytocin helps to move milk from the ducts in the breast to the nipple and to foster a bond between mom and baby. Our bodies also produce oxytocin when we're excited by our sexual partners and when we fall in love. And that's why it's been called the love hormone, the cuddle hormone, and the love drug. And studies have shown that oxytocin decreases stress and anxiety and can have a positive impact on social behaviors when it comes to relaxation, trust, and overall psychological stability. And according to Harvard Medical School, oxytocin production and secretion are controlled via a positive feedback loop. This means the hormone causes an action that stimulates more of its release. This can be achieved by snuggling up with someone, giving someone a massage, making love, or simply hugging someone. All of these things lead to higher levels of oxytocin and well-being. And dopamine is the chemical that gets the reward system going. Ever been love struck? If so, high levels of dopamine have been released and activate the reward circuit, which can feel like the kind of euphoria that is associated with the use of alcohol or cocaine, thus making the experience extremely pleasurable. This creates a motivation-reward effect and is where the addiction part of love comes in. Even if we are faced with dangerous obstacles or situations that can end up being painful, like cheating on a partner, we will seek out that reward despite the potential pain and suffering in the future. It just feels too good to our addicted brain. The individual will chase or pursue things that trigger that rush or high and assign importance to those activities, be it sex, the chase, romantic love, or whatever the case may be, to satisfy or get the high of the motivation-reward effect. Basically, dopamine controls the reward system in the brain. It also processes emotions. Because of all of this, dopamine is what motivates us to seek out things we find pleasurable and rewarding. It also plays a central role when it comes to attracting a romantic partner. One reason dopamine was designed to make us seek a romantic partner is the survival of our species. Dopamine makes it such that we desire to find a mate and reproduce. For this reason, dopamine provides a lot of positive feelings, but there is also something called love blindness for evolutionary purposes, in that our genes could care less whether or not we are compatible when it comes to lifestyle, politics, religion, and so on. The only focus is on reproducing and the mere compulsion to do so. This is why a new love may be viewed as being perfect via love blindness. It's all due to neurobiology and the survival of the species. So if you look back on your dating history weeks, months, or even several years later and say to yourself, what was I thinking? How in the world was I attracted to that person? Neurobiology is to blame. It's almost like our brain cast a love spell or gave us a dose of love potion number 9. And if we look at hormones from perspectives of being hurt, cheated on, or dumped, the emotional pain that we experience results in the release of endorphins, and because of the brain's neuroplasticity, or the brain's ability to change and adapt due to experience, an association is made between the pain you feel and the release of endorphins, which give you that euphoric feeling, resulting in you thinking the pain and euphoria are connected and therefore necessary to feel good. Norepinephrine is similar to dopamine, but is released in the beginning stages of love, or sometimes what is lust or infatuation. This results in feeling excited, giddy, and euphoric. This hormone is part of the attraction stage of love, and high levels of both dopamine and norepinephrine are released. And we've all heard someone say, "I'm so in love, I can't eat or sleep." Well, that is this stage of love in which the release of dopamine and norepinephrine can lead to a decreased appetite and insomnia. Norepinephrine is also known as noradrenaline, which plays a large role in the fight or flight response, which kicks into overdrive when we are stressed, thus keeping us alert. At the beginning of romantic love, cortisol levels increase. Research shows that higher levels of cortisol released by the brain in the first 6 months of love are suggestive of the stressful and arousing conditions associated with the initiation of a social contact. However, cortisol levels lower during sex with a partner, which helps us to ease into a relaxed and vulnerable state that can make us feel attached and infatuated with the other person. When we engage in what some call meaningless sex, a booty call, or one-night stands, that vulnerability factor often is not there initially due to a lack of closeness, but once you get a boost of hormones, that makes you feel attached and vulnerable to the other person. Now enter serotonin. Serotonin is primarily responsible for regulating behavior and mood and is affected by love. And interestingly enough, according to Post University, for men, serotonin levels decrease in response to a romantic relationship, while women experience a significant increase in serotonin. The research also found that higher serotonin in women was associated with obsessive thinking about romantic partners. Knowing all of this, when we think back to our first love, we experience all of these hormones at high levels and all at once for the first time. Then, all of a sudden, in most cases, all of those euphoric and first-time feelings were then suddenly gone for the first time. Heartbreak is very complex and not a one-size-fits-all. It can be extremely emotional, but we can all probably attest that the first time is the worst and most challenging heartbreak because it is the first experience. Of course, there can be heartbreak later on as well that can be just as excruciating, but the first one hits you hard. And according to a 2017 study from the Journal of Positive Psychology, 71% of people can heal from a breakup within a span of 3 months after the relationship has ended. And to operationalize or clearly define healing in this context, the study is referring to the feeling of rediscovery of self, which we've talked a lot about on this podcast, and feeling more positive emotions. And in a previous episode, I talked about Barbara Fredrickson's broaden and build theory of positive emotions, which posits that positive emotions broaden people's momentary thought action urges and ultimately lead them to take action to build personal resources related to survival. This expands our awareness and increases our ability to think creatively, thus creating an upward spiral of sorts that spurs us on to be more engaged with the world, develop new skills, and collect new resources, all ultimately leading to even more positive emotions. And when it comes to love, Fredrickson's perspective works in a similar way, in that she refers to love as the supreme emotion that ripples out into other positive emotions like gratitude, joy, and happiness. And if you want to read more in depth on this, take a look at Fredrickson's book, Love 2.0, in which she states, to absorb what the new science of love has to offer, you'll need to step back from love as you may know it. Chevens and Feldman further explain, love isn't passion. It isn't a bond of commitment. It isn't loyalty. It isn't unconditional trust. It isn't a family connection, and it isn't even romance. These experiences can accompany love, but they aren't what Fredrickson means by the word love itself. Instead, she defines love as a moment-to-moment emotional experience characterized by warm and mutual caring. In a moment of such loving connection, we become sincerely invested in the other person's well-being for its own sake. Fredrickson refers to real love as shared positivity, which can range in being shared by romantic partners, friends, or even strangers. It is simply a warm interaction in which two people connect over a shared positive emotion. It is in moments like this that our brains and behaviors sync up, or as Fredrickson calls it, positivity resonance. People mirror each other's behaviors like tone of voice, postures, or nodding along with one another. Of course, returning to the topics of breakups, feelings like sadness, anger, and resentment may linger for a while. And going through a breakup or the end of any relationship, really, you will find yourself navigating through the stages of grief, which include denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, sometimes repeating some of the stages and not experiencing them in any particular order, but bouncing around in your grief until you are healed and feel more positive emotions and a reconnection with your authentic self. There's not a ton of research on why the hurt from our first love tends to linger longer than others, but what we know about the brain and the intensity of varying levels of hormones for the first time all at once, and the feeling of running full speed into a brick wall when that love ends, we can surmise that our first love is the most important because it is foundational and most likely occurring during adolescence when our brains are still developing, thus leaving hormonal imprints that can be triggered by a song, a place, a smell, or a photograph. And according to couples therapist Dr. Nailu Dardashti, the feelings we experience with our first love become a blueprint for how we approach future relationships. In a very real way, just as our perception of platonic and familial love is forged in childhood by our parents or caregivers, our idea of romantic love is impacted by how we experience it for the first time. Okay, so there you have it. In this episode, I talked about excuses versus explanations, love hormones, and why our first love has lifelong psychological effects. Recommended readings related to this episode include the articles The Art of a Heartfelt Apology by Julie Corliss, The Lifelong Psychological Effects Your First Love Has on You by Jamie Bell, Oxytocin, the Love Hormone, reviewed by Howard E. Lewine, MD, Chief Medical Editor at Harvard Health Publishing, and the book Love 2.0 by Barbara Fredrickson. And other important resources include the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, dial or text 988 in the United States, or 000, the National Emergency Telephone Number in Australia. And if you are interested and would like to receive daily inspiration via social media, you can join the Lemon Tree Coaching community on Instagram at The Lemon Tree Coaching. I post meaningful quotes from my weekly readings and recommend books from time to time. So check it out and see if it's for you. And teachers, you may want to check out my TPT store called The Lemon Tree by AKS. There are some free lessons you can download or explore the shop for more. Again, my shop is The Lemon Tree by AKS on teacherspayteachers.com. And thank you for listening and happy Valentine's Day. This is Dr. Allison Succomelli saying it's been a pleasure sharing this space with you. And until next time, have fun, be safe.